Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of February 11th, 2018. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Doing well. How are you doing?
Good to have you. We're also happy to be joined by author, teacher, climate hawk, and all-around winter sports enthusiast, Ms. Mariah Tinger. How are you doing, Mariah?
I'm well, thank you.
Good. So here we are. One of the major changes that has happened in the United States in terms of energy policy over the last now 10 years has been the development of a technology called fracking. It's actually called hydraulic fracturing. And it is, everyone's heard of it, right? Fracking is now old hat. But this is a new technology developed in the United States that allows, it does the following thing. In case you're not particularly familiar with what fracking does, in fracking, you can drill a hole into the ground, particularly in the kind of ground that has rocks in it, like shaley kind of places. If you live in Rhode Island, for example, you drive along the roads, you see the shale on the side of the road. It's like ancient layers of mud laid down, one on top of the other layers. But what you can do is drill a hole into the ground and then force into that hole in the ground high-pressure fluid, typically water with some nasty chemicals mixed in to be more of a lubricant kind of thing. But you push that water down there at very high pressures, and at such a high pressure that you're able to crack the rocks under the ground, turn those big solid granite rocks into little tiny pebbles. And when you do that, all of a sudden, natural gas kind of bubbles off this stuff, and now you've got a natural gas well. So fracking, hydraulic fracturing, is this technology that allows people to do this, to go find a place where there's no quote-unquote reservoir of natural gas. There's no big hole in the ground where all the natural gas is floating around. The natural gas is trapped in the rock. If you fracture the rock in this fracking process, it gives off the gas, and you can collect it. Okay, fine. What you're doing is pushing this hydraulic fracking fluid into the ground at high pressure. When it's in the ground, it can pick up little bits of the rock that's down there, little tiny dust in the rock. And what's in that little tiny bits of dust is radioactive material, typically radium. And for those of you who have been around a while know that some homes have radon gas leaking into their homes, right? All that stuff comes out of rock, and when you break up the rock, you release it. And some of this radioactive material can get back into the hydraulic fracking fluid that you just pushed down in the well. And of course, as part of this hydraulic fracking process, once you've fractured all the rock, you want to pump that liquid back out and make it disappear, because you can't use it anymore, right? You want to pump it back up, put it in a truck, drive it away to somebody else's place, and let them worry about this fluid. But of course, that fluid's been made radioactive by going into the ground, right? By the very nature of the process. And so recently, it's come to light that more and more of this material, which has been radioactive for years and will be for a lot longer, it's just being taken and dumped into leaching fields, right? Because there's no, you know, West Virginia, they don't really care. In Pennsylvania, they're not really paying that much attention, right? And it's sort of like you talk to your friend Vito, and he makes the body disappear. You don't ask any questions. It's all gone, okay, and everyone's happy. But we're spreading this radioactive material all around. And so there's a report recently that's saying, pointing this out and demanding that there be more aggressive tracking of this hydraulic material. Radioactive material, and not just let it get dumped into places. So that's something that people should be aware of, that in addition to all the other evils of fracking, right, which have been listed up in a lot of places, now we've got many millions of gallons of radioactive liquid rolling around on trucks getting dumped into the fields of West Virginia. It's an outrage.
I don't know if you remember, we both saw this talk last March, and it was a woman who had grown up on sort of the reservation in North Dakota, I think it was. She was talking about the radioactive socks, right? There's these socks that they put on and collect some of the radioactive, I assume maybe these little rocks and the radioactive material
dust and stuff,
the dust gets all caught in this sock. But what was happening to the socks? They were supposed to, of course, be, you know, responsibly put away, but they were just getting tossed, and children were picking them up and playing with them as kites, as, you know, all these. And these things are like incredibly radioactive. Right. And these children were just had their hands all over them, their hands in their mouth, their hands, you know.
Yeah, they're kids.
They're kids. I mean, it's. That's awful.
It's pretty much of an outrage, and it's just the kind of, I guess it's symptomatic of the thoughtlessness, or the, what is the precautionary principle, right? We develop these technologies that are wonderful, do amazing things, but we don't think about all the consequences, and nobody wants to pay for all those negative consequences. And that's, I mean, from a sustainability perspective, I think, Mariah, maybe you can say better than I, but the precautionary principle says, if you don't know the consequences, don't do something, right? That's how we have to live in the world nowadays, right? It's just, anyway, I just wanted to put out there that that is happening. And it's connected to a separate report that we saw this past week, which is also troubling. And the most clear-cut example was in Hurricane Harvey. I don't know if you guys heard about Hurricane Harvey down in Houston. That's a joke. of course, in Houston, along the banks of Texas in the Gulf of Mexico, there's all these chemical plants, right, that have Superfund sites that are full of toxic junk. And in Hurricane Harvey, all those things flooded. And you mixed up all the chemicals where they flowed out of the sites. It was terrible. But there's a serious risk that as sea levels rise, the sea levels will infiltrate into Superfund sites all along the East Coast and just make that stuff go into the ocean, float around. I mean, it's really a horrifying prospect, and it's one more unintended consequences of climate change. Did either of you guys see that report? Or no, was it just me?
Yes, I saw it, and again, it is something to be very, very concerned about, and not only as you read it are you concerned, you're also outraged when you start hearing people like Scott Pruitt, the EPA head, running around and saying, oh no, that this is going to be beneficial for our society. He told an interviewer in Nevada, a Nevada NBC affiliate, basically saying that civilizations flourish when this sort of stuff happens. And it's just like, it's one more example of just how deranged that individual is. And
that interview, oh my gosh, I heard that interview too, and
Hear the interview? Really?
Oh, gosh, it was insane. I mean, some of the stuff that he was saying was just, you know, like, well, we're arrogant to think we know what the climate should look like in 2100. And I'm like, I maybe some call it arrogance. I call it the desire to, you know, not fry.
Yeah, I know what I wanted. I wanted to look like the climate in 1700, right? Whatever, yeah. Or the climate today. Well, but it begs the question of how the human spirit, or the human project, I guess, how we're going to overcome people like Pruitt, and as a society recognize that we can't be making Superfund sites, right? That are dumping radioactive stuff in the field. I mean, what's the consciousness? When do we get there? And is it simply we have to put a price on everything, or is it kind of a religious, I don't know, a new way of looking at the world? I don't know. That's way too heavy. But I mean, it's just, how are we going to get there, right? How are we going to take people like Scott Pruitt and make him irrelevant? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the people who are being affected by this stuff, not just the people who are being affected, but definitely the people who are being affected, and then those of us who are paying attention need to be really vocal about it, right? I mean,
yeah, I think.
And people are. I mean, there's a lot of protests around this stuff.
Well, I think that there was something I was reading saying how most Americans do not hear any discussion of climate change most of the time, and that's a problem. And I think that, of course, we on this show do our part to talk about it, but, you know, there's millions of people who don't hear and don't care, and no one's talking to them about it, but we're doing our best, right?
That's our solution. Is we just need everyone in this country to tune into our station. Right.
So if you want to, you know, tell a friend about this podcast and tell them that they should listen. All right. Well, there's the outrage of the week. The interesting and entertaining thing of the week happened in a faraway country run by Manuel Macron, who is, I guess, a hero now. Tell me, Mariah, what happened, or what's at play in the in Paris this past couple of weeks?
Yeah, so a couple of kind of exciting things. Paris is exploring the possibilities of suing the fossil fuel industry for causing climate damages. I shouldn't say that's exciting, but I think that that's monumental. Following New York City and the other U.S. cities that have been doing that. And also the Paris City Council is lobbying other major cities such as London to ban fossil fuels from their investments. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Paris pledged to divest from fossil fuels in 2015. And we've been talking pretty frequently about New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio announcing in January that it's going to divest $191 billion pension funds from fossil fuels. And then there's major cities all over the world, Sydney, Cape Town, Berlin, Oslo, Copenhagen, Stockholm, that have also pledged to ban fossil fuels from their investments, in addition to many, many institutions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as we mentioned before, divestment was originally sort of something that was just supposed to be a political statement, but maybe not, you know, there's no way it would actually hurt the fossil fuel industry. And yet now that you're really seeing this divestment movement growing, and here we've got major cities all over the world that are doing it, it actually may deal a pretty serious blow to, who knows how far it's going to go.
Those guys have a lot of billions in their pocket, and they can throw a lot of money around. And it's just to be clear, Mariah, there's two kinds of things floating around. One is that these cities will refuse to buy fossil fuel stocks into their portfolios of whatever stocks they own. So that's one track. The second track is for cities to join New York and sue for damages. I mean, something I saw said that Paris, again, the Seine flooded again. So it overflowed its banks and within the last month, right? So Paris is subject to damaging natural events that are, you can track back to climate, and that's a basis for suing the oil company actively, just the way de Blasio did in New York, right? Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, not just, I mean, yes, you can, I think definitely a fair statement, and you can trace it back to climate, but more specifically, you know, as we've talked about, you can trace it back to, you know, just 100 or maybe 100, 200 companies that are responsible for the majority of the greenhouse gas emissions that cause climate change.
Right, right.
So that's sort of the chain that places are being able to say, well, you know, we're going to sue the fossil fuel industry because they knew that they were going to cause these damages, and they went ahead and burned fossil fuels anyway,
right.
Sowing doubt and communicating doubt in ways that were counter to public health and prosperity.
But the point the sub point there is that these lawsuits are not just sort of frivolous, let's waste Exxon's time. I mean, there is a logical sequence of connections that can be made in a court of law connecting someone like Exxon to the damage that you have. And that's what they're pursuing with the hope of recouping some of the money. And I suppose there's a punitive aspect of it as well, just the same as the tobacco lobby, right, DR? I mean, there's all the analogies between the tobacco industry and the fossil fuel industry.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, there is that, which I think is interesting and certainly heartening, right? Now, you know, for us here in the United States, I suppose nowadays we look at New York and say they're doing great. But the reality is Paris and the rest of the world are way ahead, probably way ahead of us in terms of sensibilities about climate, right? So to say that they're catching up to New York may be an overstatement, but it's certainly nice to see that unity among the big cities of the world.
Mm-hmm. So. Definitely.
So anyway, there's that. And then the other sort of entertaining, not the law of unintended consequences, but an interesting pushback. DR, you were telling me this a few minutes ago, but let me just set the story up and say that our erstwhile federal government has, after decades of refusing to let there be oil, any significant oil, exploration for oil off the Atlantic and Pacific coast, as I suppose contrasted to the Gulf Coast, where there's lots of oil rigs and off the Gulf, right? But off the Atlantic and Pacific coast, there's no oil rigs, there's no drilling. The Trump administration recently tried to allow the entire, basically the entire coastline of the United States to be subject to oil explorations. This is with Mr. Zinke, right? Stinky Zinke from the Bureau of Land Management. He decided that anybody could drill anywhere until he visited Florida, and he got in cahoots with, I guess, the governor of Florida is named Scott, and they decided, well, oh, really, you can't drill off the coast of Florida, et cetera, et cetera. So there's this possibility that oil companies can drill anywhere off the east or west coast that they please. And so with that, tell me, D.R., what happened on the west coast of our country that people ought to know about?
Well, San Francisco Chronicle reports that government officials in California are now saying they're going to block the federal government from transporting oil using existing or new pipelines. The California State Lands Commission and the California Coast Commission sent letters to the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management basically saying that they plan to pursue this course of action. Both commissions have authority over the permitting company's need to extract and move oil and gas from coastal waters. So this could seriously put a crimp in the plans of the Trump administration to allow for drilling off the Pacific coast.
And basically they're saying you can drill off the offshore if you want, but we're not going to let a pipeline come into California. Right?
Exactly.
That's the idea, clearly stated. So now the oil companies would have to have a tanker floating off there, and they'd be pumping from the oil rig into a tanker somehow. Which would be, I think, probably much more expensive than bringing it on shore. So I guess, do you think that model is, number one, defensible? Do you think they can actually, can the state of California enforce that? Or will they get overridden by some federal judge? And secondly, does that model apply to other states? Of course, I'm thinking of a place on the East Coast with a cape that extends into the Atlantic Ocean. Could we do that kind of thing here?
It'll be interesting to see what the legal ramifications are, but assuming that, in fact, California is on solid legal ground, you could easily see other coastal states basically making the same decision and thus forcing this proposal to basically go down. So it goes to show you once again, you know, all politics really is local, and this is an example of the old saying of thinking globally and acting locally.
Yeah, well, there's a will, there's a way, right? If you don't want that stuff to come in, there's ways you can fight it. I don't know. Well, okay, so those are heartening things that I would say, literally take heart. I mean, don't tread on me, right? Don't pipe on me. I'll get my yellow flag with instead of a snake curled on itself, and get a pipeline curled on itself and say, no pipes on me. Anyway, look, we gotta put it down there. But I want to remind everybody that on March 3rd, Sunday, March 3rd, during the course of the day at Northeastern University will be the Local Environmental Action Conference. Right. This is a conference sponsored by MCAN and the Toxic Action Group. It's a great conference. It's inexpensive. It's going to give you an opportunity to meet other climate hawks and activists. It's going to give you training and background about the kinds of things that you want to know. It turns out the early bird pricing ends on February 10th. So you got to get yourself out there and sign up soon. But even after the early bird pricing, it's still a pretty good buy. It's March 3rd, Northeastern University. It's on the green line. It's on the purple line. It's easy to get to. I would say I urge you to try and attend because I will be there. You can come up and say hello to me. Right, Mariah? I can be found at that conference.
I'll be there too. Yeah, okay. That's where we went there yet last year, and it had fantastic speakers and really enlightening conference.
Right. So there
and
you
before
go.
We oh,
go,
sorry,
ahead.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
So you say we just because you know I'm such a Musk fan. Just to mention that very exciting news that SpaceX launched a Roadster, right? They launched a Roadster into deep space
The story is I'll try and find the video. It's an amazing story that Elon Musk's SpaceX company. Of course, Elon Musk is the Tesla guy, right? But he also owns SpaceX. In his spare time, he builds rockets the size of the Apollo, bigger than the Apollo rocket, which is the biggest rocket that ever was until now. And they launched this Falcon, I was going to call it the Millennial Falcon, but it's not the Millennial, it's just the Falcon, the heavy Falcon, heavy rocket or something. And the marvelous part about this rocket is that the booster sections, or those things that they used to keep shooting the rocket up in the air, are not only recoverable, but they land gracefully with a rocket flame going vertically down, just like you see in the science fiction movies. And so they shot this rocket off up into the air, and the payload, the thing that they put into orbit, was a bright red, shiny red, metallic red Tesla electric car. Right, I'm thinking it's the Model 3 is the most advanced, right, or the snazziest one. It's got a mannequin dressed in a spacesuit. I think they're calling him Skyman or something from the David Bowie song. Anyway, so right now, Elon Musk has put an electric vehicle into orbit around the Earth with cameras taking pictures of the car with the Earth behind it, and. I mean, I will leave the floor open to you two guys to tell me the meaning of this, the cosmic meaning, but for somehow it makes me really happy, and I haven't figured out yet exactly what the climate connection is, but to see this electric vehicle driving around the Earth is just, I think it's entertaining, right? I mean, did you guys see the pictures at all? I mean, what? Tell me, what should I think about this?
He's got plenty of drive, you got anything.
I don't know. I don't want to put the boo on it by saying, yeah, eventually that thing will be space junk that has to be collected by some future Wall-E. Remember the movie Wall-E? Yeah. Right? Somebody driving around space picking up little pieces of junk. It'll be part of that. But still in all, it's pretty cool. I actually was looking for a screensaver so I could put it on my computer wall. Anyway, thank you for reminding me, Mariah. We're going to put up a picture of Starman in his Tesla on the website. But you can check out, you can find that at the blog. It's going to be massclimateaction.org/blog. That'll be where you can find the SoundCloud version of the thing to listen to the podcast on, the widget or the gidget, I guess they call it. You can find us on Facebook at /massclimateaction, where we sit amongst many other interesting pieces of climate information that are put up on that Facebook page. You can listen to the show directly on your smartphone using Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Overcast, Podbean, SoundCloud. You can hear us on Apple Podcast app nowadays. So we'll close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the reckless policies of the new administration not be accepted as normal, and that the United States put a long-term and equitable price on carbon. So thanks for being here, DR.
Thanks.
Thanks for being here, Mariah.
Thank you.
Thanks to Elon Musk for putting Starman in orbit. I think that's great. Anyway, we'll talk to you all again soon. Thank you all very much for listening. We'll see you again. See you at the conference, March 3rd. Bye-bye.
Very cool.